It is now my pleasure to introduce Michelle Mitchell to you. Michelle received her PhD from Northwestern University and is author of Righteous Congregation, African Americans and the Politics of Racial Destiny. From 2005 to 2008, Michelle was North American co-editor of Gender and History, and she's also served as a humanities scholar in residence at the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. Michelle is an associate professor of history at New York University, where she teaches a course on the history of Black women in America, and she's currently working on a new project about race, gender, and idleness in the Great Depression. So please join me in welcoming Michelle Mitchell.
Good evening. It's an immense pleasure to be here, and I was not expecting such a large turnout, so I appreciate your coming out to hear this speech this evening. And if I need to enunciate any point a little bit more, speak louder, please let me know. I tend to sometimes speak a little fast and a little muffled when I get nervous, so just see that. I must admit that it never really occurred to me to explore Lorena Hansberry's connection to Greenwich Village before the Greenwich Village Society for Historical Preservation asked me to do so. That is hardly to say, however, that I never thought about Hansberry or her work. From the very first time that I offered an undergraduate course entitled Black Women in America at the University of Michigan in the fall of 1998, both Hansberry and the film version of her play, A Raisin in the Sun, were included on my syllabus. Indeed, when I taught an updated version of the course this last fall at NYU, both Hansberry and Raisin remained on my syllabus because they are integral to the course. Other writers, readings, and cultural productions have come and gone with successive iterations of the course, but I continue to teach Hansberry because of her complex vision of Black women, because of her feminist politics, and because, as a lesbian who was married to a man for most of her prematurely short adult life, Hansberry's life underscores that some lesbians during the mid-20th century either married men or stayed married to men because they felt that they had few other options. I teach A Raisin in the Sun because Hansberry's rendering of the fictional younger family speaks volumes in terms of racial, gender, sexual, and class politics. I then continue to teach Hansberry because I believe that one of her most important legacies is her progressive sexual, race, gender, and class politics. Her own life experiences turned Hansberry into an intellectual activist. Not only did she write about racial oppression, she also wrote about feminism. As a lesbian, Hansberry spoke out against oppression of gays and lesbians in two letters to pioneering lesbian publication, The Ladder. She also wrote an unpublished letter to One. If Hansberry's own husband, the couple divorced in 1964, Robert Nemiroff would acknowledge that Hansberry's homosexuality was, quote, not a peripheral or casual part of her life, but contributed significantly on many levels to the sensitivity and complexity of her view of human beings and of the world. Writer Neil Miller argues that Hansberry's work even anticipated some of the ideas of gay liberation. It is hard to know what might have been had Hansberry not died in 1965 at the age of 34. It is tempting all the same to wonder about what might have transpired had she lived through the tumult of the late 60s, the revolution and retrenchment of the 70s, and the effervescence of Black feminist writing during the late 70s and into the 80s. Hansberry might have been among the few African American who helped found the National Organization for Women in 1966. She might have been among the Black lesbians who formed the Combahee River Collection in 1974. And it's in terms of creative output, it's also tempting to think about what she would have done with later work, in terms of work that might have resonated with Ntozake Shange's The Colored Girls, Audre Lorde's Zami, and even Alice Walker's The Color Purple. It is possible that Lorraine Hansberry's writing might have followed a different trajectory, one suggested by her 1964 play, The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window. Brustein had but one Black character, and it did not speak specifically to the experiences of Black women. The play instead featured Greenwich Village intellectuals who could be limited, if not hamstrung, by misplaced intentions, cynicism, and inertia. The play additionally featured a prominent male homosexual character. In other words, Hansberry might have gone on to become a writer whose work spoke to class, racial, gender, and sexual politics, but one who is not always or necessarily focused on people of African descent, let alone Black women. Tonight, however, I shall not focus upon what might have been. I shall not even discuss The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, as Hansberry only plays set in the village. Rather, I shall largely consider how Hansberry integrated biographical aspects of her life into her landmark play, A Raisin in the Sun, yet I shall do so not primarily by focusing upon her childhood in Chicago, which definitely informed the play. What I wish to do in part is think about how the character beneath the younger in the play is a reflection of Hansberry during her 20s when she worked in Harlem, lived on the Lower East Side for a time, took classes, attended meetings, participated in protests, moved to the village, and immersed herself in the village's intellectual, political, and creative ferment. As I talk about Hansberry's life when she moved to New York, I shall draw upon recent work that describes her personal relationships, including intimate partnerships with women. To be sure, A Raisin in the Sun does not include or explicitly address lesbian relationships. The play's one explicit reference to homosexuals comes when the character Walter the Younger disparages one of her sister's suitors for wearing, and I'm quoting from the play here, faggy-looking white shoes. All the same, heterosexual marriage is unstable in the play. It is questioned. In her article, To Become Young, Gay, and Black, Lorraine Hansberry Existentialist Roots to Anti-Colonialism, Cheryl Higashida suggests, as does literary scholar Alan Wald, that it is possible to read texts by gay and bisexual writers on the left and look for places not obvious in a first reading that are the sites of additional, alternative, or coded dramatizations of sexual images and themes. I will then spend part of my talk this evening examining such spaces within A Raisin in the Sun in an attempt to understand how Hansberry might have been articulating arguments about sexuality that at very least unsettled heteronormativity.
Next slide, please.
Thank you.
Lorraine Vivian Hansberry was born in Chicago, Illinois, to Nanny Perry Hansberry and Carl Augustus Hansberry on May 19, 1930. The youngest of four children, she grew up in relative comfort due to her father's success as a real estate broker. Her mother's income as a school teacher further contributed to the family's resources. Not only were both of her parents politically active, but the Hansberry home was an intellectual hub of sorts on the south side of Chicago. Next slide, please. Thank you. A range of African-American luminaries visited the Hansberry household, the scholar, writer, and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, author Langston Hughes, the NAACP's Walter White, composer Duke Ellington, not to mention her uncle, Leo Hansberry, a prominent professor of African history at Howard University. The home was also visited by a host of African students and exiles. Indeed, the political discussions to which Lorraine and her siblings, two brothers and a sister, were exposed to were in part seemingly meant to inculcate a sense of responsibility, engagement, and activism in them. As Michael Anderson has noted, Lorraine's eldest brother fought induction into the Jim Crow Army during World War II, and her sister found herself spending a prom night nervously sitting with her date in a restaurant suspected of mistreating black patrons. But Hansberry's actually lived in a string of apartments, that is, until 1938, when Hansberry pictured this three flat that's pictured. And this three flat is in on South Roads. If you know Chicago at all, there's the University of Chicago, and Woodlawn is right adjacent to that. So it's really close to Hyde Park and the University of Chicago. Lorraine was 8 years old at the time. The Hansberry quickly experienced violent hostility in their new home from their neighbors. Once, for example, when Lorraine and her sister Mamie were sitting on their porch, an angry mob surrounded them. After fleeing indoors, a brick came crashing through the window that almost struck and killed Lorraine. Hansberry would even later recall that she, quote, remembered her desperate and courageous mother patrolling our house all night long with a loaded German Luger, doggedly guarding her four children against any tragedy that might befall them at the hands of, quote, howling mobs. The Hansberrys had to endure more than mob violence. Due to restricted housing covenants that then prevailed in Woodlawn, a select group of neighbors obtained a court order that effectively evicted the family from their home. Restrictive covenants were written clauses, as many people know here, were written clauses within housing deeds and rental leases that stipulated that owners could neither sell nor rent to, quote, persons of another race or creed. Carl Hansberry decided to fight restricted housing covenants by filing a series of lawsuits through the NAACP. Next slide. He did so for his family and to protect his investment. But Carl Hansberry also did so on behalf of African Americans in Chicago at large, and his case made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The court's 1940 decision in Hansberry versus Lee did not strike down restricted housing covenants altogether. That would not occur until 8 years later with the court's decision in Society versus Kramer. The Hansberry versus Lee decision, though, did allow the Hansberrys to occupy their house,
at 6140 South Rose Avenue. The court essentially determined that there was not a clear and overwhelming majority of white residents of Woodlawn who supported restricted housing covenants or who opposed the Hansburys living there. Therefore, the court decided that the Hansburys could not be kept from occupying their home. Whereas Hansbury was herself from a relatively middle-class household, if you've read To the Young, Gifted, and Black, you can see this reminiscence that she has of being in kindergarten when, during the Depression, her parents buy her a white fur, of all things. And they send her to school in this white fur, and she's going to school with working-class and poor kids, and not surprisingly, they resent it, and they ruin the code. And this really makes a really serious impression upon her. She attended school with poor and working-class kids, who she remembered later as children who, quote, invariably lived in walk-up flats where it was bare, very bare and rugless, children who had their own door keys about their necks because no parents whose own bodies might be worn down by overwork, would be home after school. As somebody who grew up in a black belt where families from different black class backgrounds lived in close proximity, she certainly knew about struggling black families, such as the one that she would later depict in A Raisin in the Sun. Indeed, her own family's experience with housing segregation and discrimination undoubtedly informed her eventual observations that the very act of surviving racism could be a form of protest. Living in a highly segregated city such as Chicago not only made Hansberry acutely aware of the interconnectedness of race and poverty, but she would later observe that her own education was affected by this interconnectedness. She would contend as an adult that she, quote, could not add, subtract, or multiply with ease as an adult due to the difficult choices that her teachers were forced to make in all black schools. Hansberry nonetheless would also say that she was able as a child to grasp university-level reading materials when she was in the sixth and seventh grades, and that certainly suggests that she was intellectually gifted. Next slide, please. She entered the University of Wisconsin during the winter of 1948 at 17, almost 2 years after her father died unexpectedly in Mexico. Her father, even though he won the case in Hansberry versus Lee, he actually became bitter and disillusioned with the racial situation in New York, and he intended with his wife to retire in Mexico, so that's why he was in Mexico, and that's where he died prematurely. Yet Hansberry perhaps began her college career awkwardly, as you remember, in terms of her coursework. She would be entranced by her production of Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock, and she would immerse herself in progressive politics. University life in Madison, Wisconsin did not seem to suit her, however, and she moved to New York City during the autumn of 1950. Next slide. It was in New York where Hansberry would flourish. She joined the staff of Paul Robeson's Harlem-based paper, Freedom, in 1951. There, she wrote about conditions facing urban blacks, in addition to women's rights, the arts, African history, and politics. She worked with Robeson closely and even attended a 1952 peace conference in Uruguay in his stead, and this is where this image is from. Hansberry continued widening her intellectual horizons as well. For example, not only did she teach a course on public speaking for progressives at New York's Frederick Douglass Education Center, but she even studied African history with W.E.B. Du Bois at the Jefferson School of Social Science. Her skills and political commitment were certainly recognized at Freedom. She became the newspaper's associate editor in 1952. If, as Michael Anderson notes, Hansberry confessed that she felt, quote, confused and stifled inside when she arrived in New York, she was nonetheless energized by life in the city. In a letter that she wrote on a dark and hot and July night in 1951 to her best friend from Wisconsin, Edith Cullen, Hansberry updated Cullen about her sundry activities. I can't remember how much I told you last. Probably a lot of nonsense about Greenwich Village. Fact is, I have finally stopped going to school and started working, which means a lot of things. I work for the new Negro paper, Freedom, which in its time ought to be the journal of Negro liberation. I live, to my total dissatisfaction, on the Lower East Side, share an apartment with 3 other girls, and would prefer to live in Harlem. However, it is too damn crowded in the ghetto, even for those who want to move in. My roommates are nice, so is the place, but there is little privacy, and I am writing in a serious way these days. See only foreign movies, no plays hardly, attend meetings almost every night, sing in a chorus, usher at rallies, make street corner speeches in Harlem, go for long walks in Harlem, and talk to my people about everything on the streets.
Hannah's very letter suggests that she found Harlem particularly compelling and inspiring. But her quick observation that one of her former letters likely contained, quote, a lot of nonsense about Greenwich Village, nonetheless suggests that Hansberry was entranced with the village as well. Next slide. In addition to the politically engaged, her political engagement with people on Harlem streets, some of the meetings and rallies Hansberry attended were in the village. And when she was covering a demonstration in the village protesting the exclusion of blacks from New York University's basketball team in 1951 or 1952, I believe it's in the winter, early 52, Hansberry met a graduate student protester, Robert Nemiroff, whom she would marry in 1953. She and Nemiroff, as many people know here, were in many ways intellectual companions, the local companions, and Nemiroff later recalled that, you know, they got married in Chicago. Both families were fine with their getting married. They got married in Chicago, and he notes that right before the marriage, they spent time at a vigil protesting the upcoming execution of the Rosenbergs. After marrying Nemiroff and moving to a walk-up apartment on Bleecker Street between West 10th and Christopher Streets, next slide. Right now, this is a florist, and apparently when they moved into this, it was a hand laundry, Joe's Hand Laundry. Mm-hmm. Some sources say that they lived on the second floor, some say on the third floor, some say on the fourth floor. At any rate, it was a walk-up, this is where they lived. Hansberry quit full-time work when they moved to this apartment at Freedom so that she could concentrate on her own creative writing. She did not stop working for wages altogether, though. Indeed, she worked at a succession of jobs in addition to freelancing for Freedom. She made and sold labels into furs. She did clerical work for the department store Wanamakers. She served as a theatrical production assistant. She wrote for the folk magazine Sing Out. She even ran programs for a progressive interracial summer program in the city. On occasion, Hansberry even waited table in her in-laws restaurant, Potpourri, which was on Washington Place. Jerry Tolmer, one of the founders of the Village Voice, met Hansberry during this time period. He would later remember in an obituary for the director Lloyd Richards, Hansberry was a beautiful, coffee-colored, silent young woman who was a waitress in a tiny restaurant just off 6th Avenue. There would come a day, many, many days, when she would come into the office of the Village Voice, which she read religiously, front page to back, and talk with us about everything and anything in the world. But there in the beginning, who knew that this wordless wisp of a waitress could talk, much less write? And write she did. Hansberry writing ranged from dramatic pageants for political rallies and churches to formulating plots for fictional plays, novels, and short stories of her own. Cheryl Higashida points out that Hansberry wrote two feminist plays during 1955 alone, one entitled The Apples of Autumn and the other entitled Flowers for the General. Both of these plays, very significantly, though unpublished, both of these plays prominently featured lesbian characters. In both plays, Hansberry's lesbian characters are tragic, and she approaches lesbianism as a social problem, but she does explicitly address sexuality in a way that she did not in other plays that were published and produced. In Flowers for the General, Hansberry's lesbian characterization is relatively complex. There are some women who are viewing in her play who view lesbianism as a sort of period that they're going to go through. There are others who are sort of, this is my choice, this is my sexuality. So it does have sort of tragic portrayals, but it also has more complex and nuanced portrayals as well. In 1958, a year after she sent two anonymous letters to the lesbian publication, The Ladder, in which she linked homophobia and women's oppression, Hansberry would also begin drafting a play with an entirely lesbian cast of characters, Andromeda, the Thief. And unfortunately, I can't say much more about these plays because these plays, being unpublished, they're in her papers that are at the Schomburg. And so I've not had a chance to actually read these plays, but apparently Andromeda, the Thief is this sort of like full-scale play that she really sort of had feminist themes, lesbian themes, very, very prominently featured. I also want to point out, many people here undoubtedly are familiar with the content of her letters to The Ladder that were published in 1957. But very significantly, the letters addressed two main themes. One of the themes that the letters addressed had to do with how lesbians self-presented, whether or not they dressed, you know, as butches, as femmes, whether or not they, you know, they wear dresses, and whether or not, you know, that sort of reflected false consciousness, you did choose to present yourself in a more femme way.
another letter that she wrote had to deal with the issue of lesbians who remain married to men. And in that letter, she argued that, you know, these women were not necessarily dupes or prey to false consciousness necessarily. She pointed out that many women probably remained married or got married in the first place because they didn't think they had any other options because of social pressures, and very significantly because she thought that in many cases that there were economic reasons that kept women in such marriages. And it's hard to say for sure, but more likely than not, one of the reasons why she stayed in her own marriage, in addition to her creative partnership with Lynn Roth, had to do with economic reasons. In addition to working part-time jobs, freelancing, and trying her hand at creative writing, Hansberry continued to participate in the political and cultural life of the city. Writer Elise Harris notes that a salon-like atmosphere existed in Hansberry and Nemiroff's Bleecker Street apartment. She writes, after long nights holding forth with friends about McCarthyism, American racial politics, and Arthur Miller, the newlyweds crashed out in the book-lined apartment. And apparently a lot of politics had to do with the advent of McCarthyism and the dynamics. Hansberry, when she was engaged in progressive politics in Wisconsin, was involved with the progressive campaign of Henry Wallace for president. So she was involved with progressive politics there. I should note that Freedom, the paper that Robeson published out of Harlem, was associated and affiliated with the Communist Party. It's not clear exactly when she joined the Communist Party, but she did join the Communist Party at one point. I cannot speak to whether or not when she left the party. But she definitely remained, I mean, just as many people did during the early 50s and mid-50s, engaged with the dynamics of McCarthyism. And as many people undoubtedly know here, McCarthyism had a strong bent in terms of homophobia and persecuting gays and lesbians and trying to drag them out of the government at the time. There's a wonderful book by one of my friends, David Johnson, called The Lavender Scare. It's a really good book about this country.
Harris suggests that within a few years of their marriage, it is quite possible that Hansberry's relationship with Nemiroff was more of a romantic friendship than a sexually companionate marriage. In a somewhat different fashion than does Harris, Anne Cheney also notes that Hansberry and Nemiroff shared a deep intellectual and political bond, and that together they absorbed much of the creative magic of Greenwich Village. They would sometimes listen to folk singers in Washington Square, she writes, or drop into the Minetta Tavern, or go out to plays and movies. Indeed, it was the very act of going to a play that largely inspired Hansberry to write her best-known work, Raisin in the Sun. As Hansberry told a New York Times reporter named Nan Robertson in 1959, one night after seeing a play that I won't mention, I suddenly became disgusted with a whole body of material about Negroes. Cardboard characters, cute dialect bits, or hit-swinging musicals from exotic sources. And there she's more likely than not referencing Carmen Jones, that was made into a movie with Dorothy Dandridge, which indeed, in terms of the hit-swinging exotic, that's a good part of what it's about. Hansberry sat down to write what she initially titled The Crystal Stair during 1956, between her 26th and 27th birthdays, she later recalled. The word would be inhabited by what she termed, quote, honest to God, believable, many-sided people who happened to be Negroes. Her timing was good in the sense that her husband, Bob, sold a song, Cindy O' Cindy, that became a hit for Eddie Fisher in 1956. I've never heard of this song. Yes?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A good song?
Yeah. In the Cindy.
This is good to know. As many people know, Nemiroff was, he wrote music, he was also a music producer, and so the money from that song enabled Hansberry to quit the various jobs that she was doing and really focus full-time on her writing. Hansberry would, however, encounter difficulties convincing producers to back her play, and in a number of interviews from the 50s, she talks at some length about the frustration that she had in terms of getting producers to believe that this work, A Raisin in the Sun, was believable, getting them to want to sort of feature sort of fully fleshed out characters. And she said at one point that, you know, trying to say that I want to present like
people who just happened to be Negroes was like talking to stone, she put, because people could not see black people as people or black characters as people. She was, however, able to stage the play after Phil Rose and David Kogan provided financial backing. Her Raisin in the Sun, let's see here, next slide, please. We'll get to this shortly. This is very close by, very recognizable in terms of the building that's to the right of Babbo, Mario Batali's restaurant. That was a home that she was able to purchase with money from Raisin in the Sun. So she moves there in 1960, but she remains on Bleecker Street for quite some time. The next slide after this. Thank you. Yes. That's what I wanted. So it toured in New Haven, Philadelphia, and Chicago before landing on Broadway. It first landed in, on Broadway at the Ethel Barrymore Theater. I could not find a picture of that, so I have a picture here of the Belasco, where it moved around October of 59. It moved there in part because it was a theater that had more affordable seats, a greater range of more affordable seats. Since many people are undoubtedly familiar with either the play and or the film version of A Raisin in the Sun, I shall not go into great length about its plot, other than to offer some brief, broad contours. Next slide. Thank you. The story is set in Chicago after the Second World War and features the Youngers, an intergenerational family cramped into a small flat in a subdivided building on the south side. This is part of Hansberry drawing from her own life, and this was actually a source of tension for her with other black artists. Once it came out that she based the play on that sort of part of her life, but that it wasn't her family who lived in a cramped flat, but that her family, in terms of the real estate holdings, their real estate holdings included a large number of such kitchenette apartments that poor people lived in. The family, the Younger family, is about to receive a $10,000 insurance policy left to the family by the deceased Walter Younger, a man who worked most of his life as a servant. Much of the story involves the family members' competing dreams for that money. Benita, the daughter, wants money to help her continue her education, specifically to go to medical school. The son, Walter Lee, wants money to open a business.